Welcome to another episode of Life 2.0. I'm John St. Augustine, absolutely delighted, nearly beyond words. Not quite beyond words, because I got a lot of words for you this morning, and mostly have to do with water. We are at the end of Earth Week. This is a Saturday episode of Life 2.0, and my initial idea was to have an episode every day. 5 days this past week would have an episode of somebody different, and it just became, scheduling-wise, not possible to do that. So the last show you would have heard, actually the first in this little series, is with Bill Curtis, and we covered a lot of ground about Earth Matters, the project he and I worked on for a few years, and talked about some of the things that he's observed as a journalist, and that kind of kicked things off. And just, again, the way that the scheduling worked out, I had to cram a bunch of interviews in just a day and a half. And then the process of editing those out and getting them ready for time and all the things that go with it took a little longer than I thought. So because Earth Day really is every day, what I've decided to do over the next few months is to put these interviews in with people that I've talked with about environmental things. And I have to get back to inserting the Earth Matters one-minute vignettes that I spent 3,000 hours producing originally from 2013, somewhere there till 2017, in that time frame. I realized as I was listening to the show that Bill and I did the other day that, this is what prompted it. The question I asked him about if he still had hope that things were going to quote unquote work out okay for humans as a species, he was talking about pieces of the puzzle and you know, that you do what you can where you are with what you have. And looking any further than that would create apathy. And that is what Jane Goodall said is the number one challenge we face as a species, that there's nothing we can do about what's going on. Well, that's true. And there have been times I felt in this lull, it's like, you know, we're chopping away at a really big wall here, the wall of consciousness, where there are people who, you know, are being all careful about the Cyrus, the virus, and they're, you know, wearing gloves and masks and things, and then they throw them on the ground. Not unlike the 70s when I grew up, where people just threw shit out the window of their car. So that's a consciousness problem. It's not even a belief system, I don't think. It's a consciousness problem. It's about being conscious enough to understand that every single thing that you do creates a ripple effect, for the better or for the worse. So, great. You keep it protected. Fantastic. And then I walk outside of a supermarket, and there's 100 rubber gloves laying on the ground. I don't know how to do much about that. So if that was my focus, I'd quit doing the things that I do. It'd be like, what's the point? Well, there is a point. It's what Bill said the other day. It's this is my piece of the puzzle. And for going on 23 years now, radio in all its different formats for me, whether it was terrestrial radio, Sirius XM satellite radio, stuff I've done with the vignettes with Earth Matters, producing one-minute things and specials and work with other people, all comes down to that. My job is to do the best I can with what I have, where I'm at, to help elevate consciousness somehow, to get people to see at least a little bit that whether you like it or not, and a lot of people don't, you are inextricably and unequivocally connected to the life force of this planet. Without it, we're screwed. There's no life. And as mentioned in the last episode, and I'll mention a lot more in the coming episodes, if there was ever a time where we realized our insignificance, it would be now. This is a virus that does not respect borders, doesn't respect your politics, your religion, your gender, your morals. It doesn't matter. And as humans have retreated back into our shelters, nature does what nature does best, cleans up after us. We're not real good at doing that ourselves. Policing our own shit on the floor, not a big deal. It's like, you know, it's like I used to say it like this. If you get invited to somebody else's house for a party, you go over there, have a great time, but rarely do you clean up before you leave. Usually the people that own the house have to clean up after everybody. Well, this is all our house. And I always imagine, like, if, and I've talked with a lot of people that are deniers of just about anything. You know, the first of all is denial that there's any way, shape, or form that 7 billion of us could possibly have an impact on this huge planet. That denial is our Achilles heel. Because if you can't get past that, you'll basically do nothing. But I always say to them, well, would it be okay for you to have an oil spill like there was in the Gulf of Mexico 10 years ago in your backyard? Well, of course not. Fine. Would it be okay if they started digging next door to you and created a landfill so everybody else could put their shit in there right next door to you? Of course not. And I go down the list of these things that are happening around the world, but they are not part of most people's experience. And until they are part of your experience, they're somebody else's problem. And that is a huge problem. That's a huge problem. So one of the things I've always made every attempt to do on this show is to make sense out of the senseless. It makes no sense to me to have somebody spend money on PPE, use it, and then throw it out in the supermarket parking lot. It never made sense to me as a kid watching people throw, you know, food containers and God knows what else and dumping ashtrays out of their car window at a stoplight. So in some way, shape, or form, this is my piece of the puzzle. This is what I'm doing with what I have to hopefully prompt conversation and then change some action. One of the things we talked about in the episode with Bill was that whole microbeads thing, and that over a 10-year period of time, I watched this story bounce around, and finally we did a vignette on it, the microbeads vignette, which was the polyethylene beads that were in facial scrubs that were working their way into the Great Lakes and that fish were eating, and they're not supposed to eat them, and all the stuff that went on, and eventually those beads were banned. Now, there were a few people that didn't like it, but so what? They found other ways and other things to put in facial scrubs, natural things. So push comes to shove, we usually do both. We push and we shove until we get our way, or we don't. And sometimes the greater good's more important. One of the things I wanted to touch on, you know, I'm mostly going to be talking about water today. Richard Hyman's going to be joining me in just a few minutes, and we're going to give him a call and talk about his work with future frogmen, which I am, you know, the word frogmen to me conjures up images of my G.I. Joe frogman guy, you know. And me and my buddy Gary were in the basement of his house with the water filled up in the wash tub and they're floating around in there. One guy was a frogman. The other guy had the big helmet on, was walking around the bottom. Very cool. So anyway, Richard Hyman's doing some great work with that because he spent a few seasons on the good ship Calypso with Captain Jacques Cousteau. That's a place I'd have liked to have been for a while, but he did it, wrote a great book about it. Now he's got a great organization that are doing incredible things around the world when it comes to the water. We'll get to that in a minute. But I was talking with a gentleman the other day, you'll hear that interview in a week or so, who is a highly esteemed meteorologist here in Chicago named Tom Skilling. And Tom is top-notch. I mean, this guy is top-notch. Researcher, meteorologist, scientist guy. I mean, he's got his finger on the pulse of a lot of things that are going on. And we were starting to have this conversation. I'm giving you a little heads up, but it needs to be repeated or at least preceded today for me, that one of the most important aspects of life on Earth is ozone. And the ozone layer that goes around this planet, you can't see from where we're sitting for sure. But it is like the sunscreen of the Earth so we don't burn up. It filters out the UV rays and does all these amazing things that really allows life on Earth to thrive as we do. It's this, you can't see it. So much like Bigfoot, there are people that believe in things they don't see. This is one thing you should believe in that you don't see. It's called ozone. It's the layer that encapsulates the Earth and protects us. So Tom and I were talking about it. You will hear it again about this when I run that episode. And he likened it to a peach, and that the skin on the peach, that thin skin on the peach, is like the ozone and the peach is the Earth. It's that thin. And many years ago, starting in the 40s, they were creating something called chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, which were propellants in air conditioning and refrigeration and deodorant sprays and things like that. And it took about 30 years to figure out, after using this stuff, that there was this hole opening in the ozone, opening and closing, opening and closing, opening and closing. And when they figured out what it was, the chlorofluorocarbons, it was the CFCs, then they realized that something must be done. Because we don't need to have that hole stay open because all the stuff we don't need is going to get in. And an amazing thing happened. Doesn't happen very often. Freaking amazing. Bipartisan agreement that something needed to be done so we don't get problems that are far worse than we can handle. Because nobody knows what happens if that hole opens 100 times bigger than it was back in the late 70s and early 80s when it was discovered. And so this action was taken. It was prompted by Maggie Thatcher, the Iron Lady from Great Britain, who was a chemist as a young woman and was able to say, this is a problem. Let me explain to all of you suits that don't like to listen, especially to women, and this is what's happening and here's why we need to make some change. And at the very same time on this side of the pond, Ronnie Reagan was president, and he was no friend of the environment, and that's neither here nor there. He was a rancher and a great guy. He sometimes just didn't get the big picture, and that's how it was. But he had skin cancer at one point. And when he realized, and when this information came around that skin cancer would be on the dramatic increase because of the increased UV rays that will get through because of the ozone layer thinning, and Maggie Thatcher sat with him and said, "Hey, Ronnie." I don't know if she sounded like that. Probably like, "Hello, Ronnie. Ronnie, we need to do something here." That's more like Monty Python. But whatever. They finally did. And they decided we need to get something done. The Montreal Protocol was enacted, and CFCs were banned. And there were CFC manufacturers that were pissed. "Sorry, your profits don't precede people." So the Montreal Protocol was enacted. The chlorofluorocarbons were banned. They found other propellants, chemicals that would not hurt the ozone layer, to use in their products. And I'm telling you right now, if today we found out that whole, and it's closed, by the way, I mean, it's much healthier than it's ever been. Slowly over time, nature has done what it's supposed to do. It's protecting itself and everything inside the biosphere that we live in. So as the ozone has gotten healthier and closed, and the CFCs, which still takes 30 years to dissipate, we're still dealing with some of this stuff. They found other ways to use propellants, refrigerants, whatever. It wasn't the end of the world, but it could have been if we didn't get our shit in one sock. So my point is that try that today. Try that today in the current climate, no pun intended, where we got these incredibly important environmental problems that are going on and a challenge that we've created ourselves. We do this to ourselves. As it's been said by Chief Seattle, contaminate your own bed, one night you'll suffocate in your own waste. And over time, we're slowly having to deal with this stuff. So you're going to hear more about that in depth with Tom later when that episode airs. But the key thing here is that action was taken, right action was taken, and that we'd have to figure out another way to do things. And is that not what we're in the middle of now with Cyrus the virus? We have to figure out other ways to do things. And as nature has reclaimed itself and the waters are getting a little cleaner and the air is clearing up a little bit, I'm not very optimistic that we're going to go, "Wow, this was a really important lesson we need to learn." My guess is that we're going to open things across the board a little too soon because we're itchy and we're not real patient. And, you know, for all our boasting and bravado that we're the greatest country on earth and we can't sit tight for a while and deal with it, I'm not real hopeful that there's going to be some big grand awakening and go, "Wow, we really need, you know, shift our gears here." I think there's another wave coming some way, shape, or form. And this was just a test to see how we respond. It's a popped-up test. How are you going to deal with it? And we've seen how people deal with it and or how they don't. So in that, I wanted to kind of segue a little bit into talking about Richard and why he's here. I found out, and you'll hear in the conversation, which is pre-recorded, I'm just being honest with you. I like putting the phone call in like we're just calling today. But anyway, what you're going to hear in this conversation is his dedication to duty, that he is continuing on the Cousteau legacy. And that's the ripple effect in action. That is the ripple effect in action. And if there was one thing that just, I mean, grinds my gears, rubs my rhubarb, and just, you know, washes the chicken for me, it's the concept of bottled water. It is the it's the biggest, in my opinion, maybe not the biggest, one of the top two or three biggest hoaxes, scams. You want to talk about a hoax or a scam? Maybe not a hoax. How about a scam? That most of the people within the sound of my voice have access to clean, safe drinking water, basically for nothing, as part of your utility. But over time, the soda and beverage companies have convinced us that that water's bad. You need bottled water. When I was a kid, here we go. When I was a kid, I drank right out of the hose. I know, living on the edge. Drank right out of the hose. Portage Park, not far from where I lived, I'd go over there and they had these huge concrete water fountains that were bubbling all the time. And there were all sort of things living in there. Drank it, didn't die. Now we have modern plumbing and everybody, you know, is to a great degree is sheltered up. And we still need to go out and spend money on bottled water. So you're not paying for the water. You're paying for the bottles and all that goes into that. When you can sell people what they already have but don't think is good for them or safe for them. And I just, get a Brita filter. I'm not endorsing anything either way, but get a Brita. You don't like the water in your tap? Go get a filter you could put on it. Please don't put more bottles into the ground. They do not go away. So this is a conscious thing. You don't like the water? Get a filter. One filter lasts you 6-7 months as opposed to buying bottles of water, bottles of water. And I see people stacking up on this one. I'm like, just buy a little tiny filter, put a pitcher, either put it on your counter or in the fridge if you like it chilled. End of story. With that in mind, here's Earth Matters with Bill Curtis.
During the winter months, it's important to stay hydrated when the weather is cold. But where you get that water from makes a difference. Here's a startling fact. More than 780 million people around the world lack access to safe drinking water. That's 2.5 times the population of the United States. More than half of all Americans drink bottled water. And yet, almost every household has access to clean, safe drinking water from the tap. Over the past 20 years, effective marketing campaigns have convinced us that we need to have water in a plastic bottle that appears to have come from some exotic source in the Alps. Truth is, most tap water is as safe as the stuff you pay $2 for at the store. We put 22 billion plastic bottles into landfills each year. Such is the power of marketing. Getting people to buy what they already have on tap for almost nothing. I'm Bill Curtis. And Earth Matters.
All right, let's get to it.
This is Richard.
Hey, Richard, John St. Augustine, good day to you.
Hey, good day to you, John. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hanging in there.
Good. Well, yeah. You've been a busy fella.
Oh, yeah, super busy. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, it's good. You're probably busy yourself, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
I have the option of with this podcasting, after doing radio for so long, I have my own studio at home, so I can reach the world from the same chair I write from, and that's a good thing. So it's great. And I want to thank you. Listen, I keep my pulse on a lot of things, and I've watched you stay with this. This is not easy work. You're going literally against the tide here in so many ways. And I just want to congratulate you for your stick-to-itness.
Yeah, well, thanks, John. That means a lot. Yeah, there are moments when you wonder why you're doing it, but
yeah.
I feel like it's my purpose in life, really. You know, yeah. I think I've arrived at this point, and we're doing some good. So, thank you so much.
I was trying to remember how we met, and I don't recall. Do you have any idea how this happened?
That's a good question. I mean, clearly the connecting point was John Denver.
Yeah, yeah.
I think perhaps you, heard about the book. And then we met and I heard about your book and, you interviewed me twice. Yeah, I think it will come down to connection through John.
I think the first time that I had you on the air was when I was at WGN here in Chicago, and we live on a massive inland sea called Lake Michigan. And
sure.
And the Shedd Aquarium is here, and a lot of research is done in this area and all these kind of things. And I remember the first time we spoke, and the concept that was with me, and one of the reasons I asked you to come on at that time, this has got to be in 2014, I would think, is because the concept about the connectedness of all the waters. You know, we tend to think that they're separate. Like, we have the five Great Lakes, and then, you know, you got the ocean on one side, then you got the ocean on the other side, then you got all the little pieces of water in the middle. But the truth is, and I think this is what one of the things I was attracted to Captain Cousteau's work and the work that you do, is that we often forget that it's all connected, whether it's saltwater or freshwater, kind of like not the main point, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really, at the beginning of this, I kept stressing all water. You know, all water is connected. Streams, rivers, lakes, ponds, the coastline, the ocean. For communication to the public, for messaging purposes, we wrestled with the mission statement, if you will, and we've arrived at a focus on the ocean. We say we foster ocean ambassadors and future leaders, because we're working with all ages, but our greatest traction is with college and university, and now we're making inroads into high school age students. But leadership development is a key aspect of this. But you know, we stress the ocean, but it's all connected. Everything runs to the ocean. Mm. So you're spot on. Yeah.
So one of the big ahas and the other hooks for me was, you know, we're within a few years of each other age-wise, and I was one of those kids in the '60s when the Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau was on television. All was right with the world for me, and I remember watching it on Tuesday nights on ABC on a little black and white Sears television in my folks' bedroom. And for me and for millions of people around the world, it was a chance to literally go places that were like as far away as the moon could be. Here I am in Chicago, and here's Captain Cousteau, you know, out on the sea somewhere, or he's at the Great Barrier Reef and doing all these amazing things. And I don't know how many times I thought, man, I would give up pretty much anything for a week just to be able to go and spend time on that little wooden ship. But you did. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, and I'm so grateful I had the opportunity. You know, I did that, and then I went on to like a conventional career and so forth. But it was always in my mind, and it's drawn me back to it. And I kind of say that Captain Cousteau and the experience infected me. But that's a bad word in today's world. But I say it in a positive way, the influence is a better word. Captain Cousteau and the adventures inspired me and left a mark on me, which I've now returned to try to try to share stories and influence people through education as well as action. Up until this year, we were really very heavily education focused, but now we are taking steps to add action and activism to our role. Of course, in 2020 now, that's hampered. Some of our outreach activities are on hold, or rather all of them are. But anyway, how did that happen, John? I was very fortunate that my father, Fred, had been recruited to basically save Cousteau. In the early 70s, the Cousteau organization was in financial difficulty, and my dad's background was in educational television and publishing. What a perfect match with someone like Cousteau, because Cousteau also did an awful lot of writing. Mm-hmm. And had a great number of books published. They were usually tied to the TV shows. You know, if they were studying a particular species or location, he would write a book about it.
Right.
And so anyway, Dad was going out to L.A. for a meeting with Cousteau, and I had just graduated from high school. I just turned 18 years old. And I always had summer jobs, but I had some flexibility, particularly that summer. And Dad said, "Do you want to come out? Join me on this trip." And I said, "Sure, yes." And I went. And that night at dinner with Cousteau, he asked me if I would help them by driving a truck from L.A. to Saskatchewan. And when I speak to audiences, particularly younger audiences, I tell them, I didn't have a smartphone I could take a peek at down underneath the table. You know, it was actually before the internet existed.
Sure.
But I said yes, and I had no idea where Saskatchewan was, but I said yes, and that's a message I try to share with people of all ages, but particularly the young people, to say yes when you have an opportunity, because it may never happen again.
Figure it out. Just say yes, then figure it out, right?
Yeah, and that led to me becoming on, being invited to back on the ship a year later as a deckhand. And once I did that, that was pretty rough grunt work, but mm-hmm. I was starting at the bottom, which is the way it should be. And I worked on my diving and I worked on my photography, and then I was invited back on two more expeditions and ultimately finished as an underwater photographer. Mm-hmm. So if I had not said yes to my dad to go to L.A. and if I had not said yes to Captain Cousteau, none of that would have happened. So
it's really interesting to me when you think of Jacques Cousteau, and the last thing I would think he'd ask anybody is to drive a truck somewhere, you know?
I know. Well, and the cool thing was that I drove the truck with a fellow named Ivan Giacoletto, mm-hmm. and Ivan is a Frenchman. Ivan is thankfully still alive, and we're sort of in touch. I'm in touch with a few other divers, but unfortunately, many have passed away. So I feel an added responsibility to share the stories. But Yvonne didn't speak any English, and I spoke poor French. But we went off on this truck, and I say a truck. To me, it was a truck. It's like a step van, like, you know, like a one of the larger UPS trucks. And but we had a great time, and we became friends, and had a wonderful time. And John, I'll just share with you that it was kind of funny, because meanwhile, there were three people leaving L.A. They were going to take the helicopter. They were pulling a helicopter on a rather flimsy small trailer with a station wagon from L.A. to Saskatchewan. And we were supposed to rendezvous with them at the Canadian border, which we did. But they broke down at least twice. And therefore, we were way ahead of schedule. So Yvonne and I, we drove through Yellowstone National Park. Wow. We went through Glacier National Park, and we just had a blast. And ultimately, we rendezvoused at the Canadian border, and then we proceeded northward and filmed in northern Saskatchewan. Mm.
It's interesting to me always when I talk to people about their journey, and there's usually like for most people, whether they're aware of it or not, there's a pivot point somewhere. Yes, I'll drive the truck, and next thing you know, well, not next thing, but you work your way up the ladder. And as you said, that is how it should be. The experiences that you have at each rung of the ladder seem to prepare you for the next one, whether you realize it at the time or not. And you did all that, then you move into more of a conventional business career. But like you said, you had this kind of really good infection going in the best way possible. How many years did you work in the private sector, the business sector, before you started feeling the pull to come back to the water?
Well, I don't think the pull ever left me, because in any spare time, I would always attempt to get to the water one way or another. You know, it just, I gained some freedom near the end of my business career, and time-wise, and that just led to, and it's kind of funny, John, the story here is that my local middle school here in Connecticut had asked me years ago if I would mentor on marine biology, and I've done that for about 10 years now, but at first I said, well, I'm willing to do that, but I'm not a marine biologist. And they said, well, we know that, but we know your background, and we'd like it if you would do it. So I've been doing that. And then that kind of graduated to high school and then college. A friend of mine who does coaching of high school kids preparing to get into college, he asked me if I would mentor a young lady, a junior in high school, and I said, sure. And Hetal Patel she was a junior in high school in Connecticut, and now she's a sophomore at University of Southern California, mm-hmm. studying environmental science, and a wonderful young lady. And I challenged her. I said, Hetal, what do you say we take this to a new level? Because I was doing some mentoring, but we decided, okay, yeah, let's do something. And Hetal said, hey, Richard, why don't we call it Future Frogmen? Mm. And I said, okay. And there's pros and cons with the name, and sure, we've debated it with the team. Frankly, and by the way, we're like 95% female.
I noticed that on the website. Yeah. You're way outnumbered, brother.
Yeah, we have 13 out of 14 interns right now are women. young women, and but we are. I just wanted to make it clear, future frogmen. We love the word future, and frogmen was derived from Adventures with Cousteau.
Sure.
But and we've toyed about changing it, and we've decided we're going to stick with it. But
if you did future frog people, it's like a sci-fi movie. So I think you're better kind of where you
are. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but we're obviously for all people.
Sure.
We feel very strongly about being inclusive. So we're all ages, all sexes. We are, and by the way, by no means just for divers. In fact,
right.
We're probably 95% of the people are not divers. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, one of the reasons I ask it around, there are many, but one of the ones that really cropped up is what I've been watching over the years. You stay with this, and I get the email updates, and I see things on Facebook and what have you, and the different places that you're speaking and what you're doing. And earlier this week, Bill Curtis and I, we did this Earth Matters series together for 3 years, 300 episodes we produced and created for radio syndication. And one of the things I asked him was, you know, he's been at this twice as long as I have, and in his time as a journalist and everything he's done, did he still see value in the effort in disseminating information that could hopefully lead to transformation? He said, he gave me an example of a guy that he had met in the Amazon. It was quite a story, but in the end, it was basically, we all have a piece of the puzzle and we never know what would happen if we don't put that in. So it's better to do it and not be concerned about if there's a ripple effect than to not do it at all. Do you feel, I know this is, as we said earlier, a bit of a tough slog. If you go back to being on Calypso and you fast forward to today, do you see the seed that was planted? Do you feel like you're putting your piece of the puzzle in no matter what?
I sure hope so. I think that's the desire. That's the intent. And it is a slog. It is a tough slog. Sometimes you wonder, but it's like it's just driving me. And I love Bill. He's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a good way to look at it. If we can contribute a piece of the puzzle here, then we're doing our job, and we're doing it in two ways. Hopefully, with our overall environment. Including our water environment, and also with the young people. Again, we welcome all ages to participate. But I will say that I'm inspired by the young people that we're working with, whether they be on our ocean ambassadors in our core team here, or the other volunteers that are working with us. They give me hope. They're smart. They have aspirations. They have energy, and it's really it's invigorating and it's encouraging.
Long time, and I try to look at everything in as big a context as I possibly can. When Captain Cousteau, you know, really created the whole underwater movement, for lack of a better term, when the Aqualung was developed and all that goes along with it. And he kept developing things, and of course, into the whole thing with the ship and then the TV and the documentaries and the books, and it just goes on and on and on. And at any point he thought, it's not worth it, none of that happened. So I'm pretty cognizant of that fact. I also don't know that he was ahead of his time when he was saying certain things. I think he was right on time, but giving us a forewarning of what could happen. And one of the quotes that has stuck with me for years is when he said, water and air, the two essential fluids on which all life depends, have become global garbage cans. He said that in like 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the big picture of the planet that's 4.65 billion years old, that's a blip in time. It's not even a little glitch of things. But we were... So much of the work that he did, if not all of it, I would guess, was to educate, inform, and inspire us to do something. And so as you carry on this work in so many ways that was started back then, I realize and I noticed on your website that you really only have three areas of focus, which I think is important because it can get too big. And the first one that I want to talk about is plastic pollution. And
mm-hmm.
There's a kid named Boyan Slot. You must know about this kid that created this floating thing that sucks up garbage. It's floating around the ocean, and he's been
yes.
working. Right. So, So I realize that humans, you know, it's always the bottom line is that the few always do the work for the many. You know, you're not going to get everybody on board, no pun intended, to get this stuff done. People have to step up. A kid like this comes out of nowhere, gets the funding, figures out some things, it helps. But I just realized, too, in the last couple of days, that even though as a species we've been cutting back because of the Cyrus the virus, plastic that is not usually in the water showing up. Now rubber gloves are starting to show up and masks. And so we're a throwaway society that plastic, which was a great idea in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and nobody knew what the hell to do with it, is now almost becoming an undoing. And at one point, I think I heard that in the next 50 years, there'll be more plastic in the water than fish. So from your perspective, with all the work that you're doing, what is the message that Future Frogmen is trying to convey?
Well, yeah, and it's those three topics that we focus on are each huge topics as well. So we've selected those as areas of focus, recognizing that they're still massive with many different aspects to them. When you talk about plastic pollution, you've got ocean debris, you've got microplastics, and you even got nanoplastics down to, microscopic particles from fabric that is also a major source of plastic pollution if it comes from, man-made materials. Mm-hmm. So I think that what we're trying to do is we are trying to share information. We're attracting intelligent, interesting people to our conversation series. We started that about a year ago, a little over a year ago in 2019, to record people. We'd have a video conference call with them, and we'd have a host, and they'd be our guest, and we'd record it, and we'd do some minor editing and packaging, and then put that up on our website, which is also connected to our YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And a way of getting information out there, and we have some loyal visitors, and then we have other people that are attracted to a particular subject and join us. But it's like you were talking about before, you know, sharing information, communicating. And then what we are trying to do relative to plastic is in the year 2020, add action. And we've got a little bit of a problem right now because we cannot do our coastal cleanups. Mm-hmm. We had a fantastic start of doing cleanups here in Connecticut on Long Island Sound, a beautiful body of water, which is really a valuable estuary. We also have plans to do cleanups of several rivers and streams that lead into the Sound. There we are gathering plastic and other materials, and we are cataloging that, and we are partnered with NOAA, the Marine Debris Program at National mm-hmm. Oceanic and Atmospheric, and so we're following their protocol and submitting data into their national database, and that's one action that we are taking relative to plastic.
One of the biggest challenges, and you've touched on it, Bill and I talk about this all the time, is how do we, if at all possible, with as much expediency and intent as we possibly can muster, create lifelines, because people are so stuck in headlines. How do we, as journalists, as authors, as advocates, as activists on behalf of this incredible planet that sustains our lives, it's fascinating to me. When I go onto your website, you're right, I see these incredible young people, and I'm thinking, I bet Cousteau would get a kick out of seeing what happened with what you've done, starting out as that skinny little kid driving a truck. I mean, I can't even imagine. What do you think he'd think of all this?
Oh, I think he'd like it. I tell you, I miss him, and I miss John Denver as well. Yeah. I wish they were both with us, because they had the guts to speak up. They had the intelligence, and they had the audience. I find that you know, one of the biggest challenges here is building an audience so you can get your message out. As I work with our student team, I tell them we're doing some really good work here. We have to keep working to build our audience as well. Otherwise, our great work is not as effective. But I think Captain Cousteau, I would hope that he would appreciate it. And it's funny, if I may, John, you talked about weather and climate.
Sure.
That reminds me of a young man at MIT, a PhD candidate there, Alex Toole. He was our first conversation guest, and we talked about how climate change is affecting precipitation, and he's brilliant and studying that in great detail. But the funny thing that he said was he likened weather to a person's mood and climate to a person's personality. You know?
That's profound.
Yeah, I thought that was a very helpful explanation.
Mm. Tell me, in the last few minutes we have together, which you know, as with everybody I've spoken to this week about Earth Week, first of all, obviously it's a daily thing, but I know that 50 years since the real initiation of Earth Day, it's really grown in magnitude, and that's a great thing. There's still so much work to be done, but that's okay. We've done some things. I'm still a little bit on the fence as to, as a species, which way we're going to end up, but you do what you can where you are with what you have, as Teddy Roosevelt said, and hope for the best and step up into it. But we mentioned, and you've mentioned, and people that listen to this show know John Denver and I were friends for many, many years, and one of the things that I connected with is what you just said a few minutes ago. Really caught me off guard. I got very emotional for a second about having the courage and the guts to say what needs to be said when it needs to be said, whether people like it or not. And I find a lot of what you're doing, you're a little bit different guy than I talked to 6 years ago. You're a little bit more forward. You've dug in a little deeper. In the past 6 years since we spoke, has this become more personal for you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I work on this every day, 7 days a week, and it's very personal. It sounds kind of corny, but I feel like this is my purpose. Aside from being a good husband and father and son and brother, this is my purpose in life, and it's very personal, and I find it hard. It's harder to speak out in some regards because there's so much bad stuff out there. There's times, you know, we try to draw a line where we don't get into certain, certain areas and invite trouble. But it's very personal. Yeah, if I can, and it's not me. It's our. It's our group. It's our team and our extended team, whether there be our interns or other volunteers or our listeners or our subscribers. Everybody counts, and if all together we can make a difference, then we're doing some good and we're helping with that piece of the puzzle.
There's a couple different variations. I'm going to use JD's version of how Calypso came about, the song. He was talking about obviously being invited on board Calypso, and within the first 10 minutes, the chorus was kind of there, and then he wanted to get the thing done. He did a little bit of the chorus on the boat, and he didn't have the whole thing, and then he thought there was a special coming up in L.A. he was taping maybe 6-8 months later, and Captain Cousteau had given him carte blanche to all the archives and whatever he needs to create a video, and he needed a video, but in order to do the video, he's got to have the music, and the music wasn't done, and then it needed an orchestra. So he goes on this whole long explanation of kind of how it came to be, and one day he said he just gave up. It's not going to happen. End of story. A great idea, could have been a great song, didn't happen. He goes skiing in Aspen, and he's maybe 2 or 3 runs down. All of a sudden, he said there was this overwhelming urge to get back home and finish the song, and by the time he drove from the mountain home in his Jeep, the rest of the song was there. He went up and played it, and the rest is history. He donated all the proceeds of the profits of that song to the Cousteau Society. Do you, by chance, have any remembrance or recollection, maybe when you may have first heard it on the radio and realized, damn, I was there when this started?
Yeah. First of all, I mean, John, it was so far out, as John would say. It was so far out to meet him, and we spent some quality time together. I'd be on watch up on the bridge of the ship, and in the middle of the night, and he'd come up and visit. And I think I like to think he was doing his research, and I was one of the only Americans. We had some chats, and but I think probably the first time I heard the song, John, was hearing him in concert. I was able to see him a couple times in concert and then go backstage and visit, and I think that may be the first time I heard it.
On a crystal clear ocean, right on the crest of a wild raging storm. To work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown. To be part of the movement, part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. Calypso, the place that you've been to, things that you've shown us, the stories you tell. I, Calypso, I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. You bring us beside you to light up the darkness, to show us the way. Although we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide and free as a windswell, joyful and loving in letting it be.
Was that like? I mean, do you have any remembrance? I mean, because you go from the guy gets on board the ship that everybody knows in the world by one name, Calypso. Within minutes, he's got a chorus. You're up there on the up on watch, having conversations, and at some point, you're sitting in an auditorium somewhere, listening to what you were part of helping create on some level. It had to be something else.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny because today even the cool thing about the talks I give now, and there are fewer of them, but I always close by playing the song set to some additional photographs, some slides in a video. And to this date, it gives me chills, and it gives certain members of the audience chills. And I'll tell you a funny story, John. I spoke at a few years ago. I spoke at a school. I've spoken to all ages, but this school was K through 12, and I did the younger kids, the older kids first, and then I went to a different campus and met with the younger kids. So they had them all lined up in the gymnasium, sitting on the floor, and like kindergarten, first row, first grade, second row, and so on. So that song comes on, and the little kindergartners, and I think some of the first graders, they're all like swaying back and forth in unison. And I'm sure they had never heard the song before, but that it just had that kind of power, even on those little ones. Mm.
I got to tell you, listen, I struggle at times to say, how else can I help? What else can I do? Where else can I apply myself? And so this conversation we're having, you know, reminds me that there's a lot of good going on in the world. You know, you have, and I've said this to everybody else, this is the people I spend time with on this show, as I had when I was on traditional radio or satellite radio, is that I think that there's a, like you said, it's a calling. Most of the people that I know that are making a serious difference and dent in the world want to see something a little bit more redeemed for them being here. And it is a calling, and sometimes it becomes a career, but mostly it's a calling. And that doesn't have a time clock. It's something that it's who you are and what you do, and it's very inseparable. And so I really salute you for the work that you're doing. And these young people, I'm on the page looking at the Ocean Ambassadors about your team, and I just think, one of them has the answer here, if not all of them. And it's not, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, guys like me, 60 years old, 61, 62 going to be, you know, I can do what I can do here in Chicago. I can make sure I get the recycling done and do whatever. And, you know, it's minimal, but these young people that are stepping up and filling in the ranks, somebody's got the answer and the pivot point within them. And I'm sure at some juncture, you're going to look back like Cousteau would look back on what you're doing and go, yep, it was the right thing to do.
Yes. Yeah, I already know it's the right thing to do, and I think you're going to see out of this group of talented young folks and others that are coming. We have several that'll join us for the summer, and as people graduate, they're welcome to stay on, but some of them will move on to careers and so forth, and we'll be bringing on other people. But I think you're going to see these people are brilliant, and it gives, like I said, it gives me hope, and yeah, I appreciate your kind words, John. Yeah.
Well, good talking to you, my friend. Yep.
Yeah, thank you so much for reaching out. It was really a pleasure. Thanks so much, John. Take care.
That's great stuff. John Denver had another song called What One Man Can Do, and he wrote it for Buckminster Fuller, who was the great inventor of the geodesic dome and many, many other things. And Bucky Fuller was an incredible human being. At one time in the 1930s, he had lost his job, and you know, he had lost his family, and he was ready to actually, he was from here in Chicago, and he was ready to off himself. He didn't think he had anything to offer the planet. He was a failure. And he had an epiphany standing really down by Lake Michigan down here. And the epiphany was, what if I was able to turn this adversity that I'm living into some sort of opportunity? What if I was able to turn this around? And he did, and he became this incredibly powerful force in the world for good. And he and John became friends later in life, and he was a big influence on the Windstar project that I had spent much time with and spoke at in 1994 and all of that. But he wrote this song, What One Man Can Do. And as Richard and I were speaking, I'm thinking, this is exactly what one man can do, or woman. Otherwise, if you just get stuck in the woulda, coulda, shoulda, nothing's going to change. It begins with you and I. But if you're sitting around waiting for permission to do something great, permission granted, right? So you don't even know if you're going to be here tomorrow, much less make it through today. So what are you spending your time on today that can matter and make a difference, a concrete, constructive difference in the world? I'm getting less and less time on Facebook, even though it's a great place to connect with people and put the, you know, the audio up and the books and the whole thing. But I see people arguing with people they don't even know about stuff that they can't do a thing about. That's called insanity. They'll lock you up for that. Well, not anymore. Now you just get on Facebook and do it. It comes to nothing. Facebook is a landfill where nobody changes their mind, nor do they change their life. So that's an inside job. And how in the world, again, I might have a couple of bolts missing, but the other ones are pretty tight here. Everything that I've learned about how to take care of the planet or my role in all this, I learned in fifth grade science. We had a terrarium. If you didn't take care of the shit in the terrarium, it all died. We live in a terrarium, a biosphere. We live on this planet. And the water is the lifeblood of this planet. And the amount that we deplete these resources that we think are finite, and they're not, you push over here and you pull over here and stuff in the middle gets wonky, we're just hurting ourselves in the long run, but we can't see it. So when a company like Nestle is pumping billions of gallons of water out of the ground and paying pennies on the dollar and putting almost nothing back into the area that they're taking it from, so you could go to the store and buy a brand of bottled water, I'm like, what the hell's going on here? Tell me we're not better than this. Tell me that this is the one call to action. This is the one thing you can do. You can't go out and do a lot of things. Let Jane Goodall handle the big stuff. Let Richard Hyman handle his stuff. I'll handle this stuff. Here's what you could do today to make a concrete, constructive difference. Stop buying bottled water unless absolutely necessary. That's what you could do. Wherever you're at listening to me now, in your home, whatever country you're listening in, from Scotland to Australia to South of Africa, up in Canada, here in the United States, don't buy bottled water. Leave it on the shelf. Don't buy it. Makes no sense. Unless you're living in Flint where you need bottled water, I got to check and see how that's going. The rest of us are okay. Every morning, have a Brita in the fridge. I also, this morning, took it right out of the tap. Right out of the tap, living on the edge. Man, fear factor. That's one of the small things you could do. That's a ripple effect right there. First of all, imagine how much money. I think that filter I bought the other day was like $7. Last 6 months. Try and live on $7 worth of bottled water for 6 months. Can't happen. Calculate how much money you spend on bottled water. And if you don't have recycling where you're at, it goes right in the garbage landfill. If you do have recycling, at least there's some point in getting it in the right direction. But even that's becoming more difficult. Just don't buy it. You know, I tell people all the time, I get that not everybody is here to do the work that I do or that some of these other people have done when it comes to the environmental stuff. I get that. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't do anything. Find the one thing that you can do and do that. And this is something anybody can do. Next time you go in a store, don't buy bottled water. Buy a Brita filter. I should get Brita as a sponsor, right? But you should just go buy a Brita filter and a pitcher. And then you fill it up. Done. Dun-de-dun-dun-dun. And with that, I thank you very much for listening. Earth matters. Until next time, adios.
Sometimes I think I'll never see the sun again. In the east, the shaded moon is hanging lazily. I do believe I saw the old man smile. I do believe I did. I do believe he's been laughing all the while. I think it's kind of interesting the way things get to be, the way the people work with their machines. Serenity's a long time coming to me. In fact, I don't believe I know what it means. There's a heavy smog between me and my mountains. It's enough to make a grown man sit and cry. It's enough to make you wonder. It's enough to make the world roll up and die. It's kind of interesting the way things get to be, the way the people work with their machines. Serenity's a long time coming to me. In fact, I don't believe that I know what it means anymore. And the sun is slowly fading in the western sky. Sometimes it takes forever the day to end. Sometimes it takes a lifetime. Sometimes I think I'll never see the sun again. The sun again.